Hello there and welcome to this live stream event on the 1st of December 2020. Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics here. Great to have you on board tonight. Lots to talk about, lots of information to share, and good to see so many on the stream already. Lots of really interesting things going on, a lot of confusing things going on too, frankly. And you might notice the slight change of scenery with the slight background. Now, as you may have seen if you saw my Edwin post yesterday, I do actually have the facility to make it go like that. But I've been told that that's rather distracting. So what do you think? Do you think it's better with or without the rotation? I'm going to take it off again. I'll just put it back to where it was. Just because I can, basically. But I've been playing with some stuff and just updating the music and a few other things as well. So anyway, great to have everybody on board. Let me just do as I normally do and just make a few introductory remarks. During that time, I'm going to be looking more at the screen rather than at the chat. So just hang with me. If you've got a question, just wait off. So this is obviously updating scenarios and mortgage stress predominantly. And we'll just start as normal with the question of the running order, which is this introduction, house rules, about our models, some key slides, and then we'll do Q&A. Q&A will be the main part of the conversation, but there are some very important slides that I want to share with you today as well. And then we'll sign off typically about an hour and a half, give or take, and plenty of time to explore postcodes if you've got particular postcodes you want to look at. People are saying freeze it. Fair enough. Ah, rotation. No, can't win. I knew that. Okay, just to remind everybody that this isn't financial advice. I'm not a financial advisor. This is my analysis and data. If you need specific financial advice, go talk to a financial advisor. Also, do play nice in the chat room. It's being moderated, so please no racial slurs. We do turn people off if they get silly, so just play within the rules. We encourage chat, of course, and I think that's one of the main reasons why people come on, is for the chat amongst each other as well as with me. And then this is at the 1st of December 2020. If you're watching this later, you know, we'll be able to tell whether I was right or wrong. Please use @walktheworld to get my attention. That's important because there are always many, many, many conversations going on the chat. And I don't necessarily follow them all, but I try to follow the ones that have @walktheworld attached to them. I've also enabled Super Chat, and that means that if you want to get your question right to the list, you can use Super Chat to do that. Or if you want to make a donation to help us fund what we do here, this isn't a for-profit entity. This is basically an entity that covers its costs to be able to actually provide information and help everybody understand what's going on. So all contributions gratefully received. Now, just in terms of the core model, I just want to highlight once again for anybody who's new that we do actually have data, and that data comes from our core market model, but specifically from our customer surveys. Surveys here are actually very important because they give me up-to-date information about what's going on. And there have been some significant changes in terms of the dynamics from the information I'm getting in the surveys. We'll talk about that shortly. It goes into the core market model with lots of other information, and that comes out to be able to support all the things that we do. And the data's concurrent up to last Tuesday, so it's very, very high-frequency data. We can slice and dice the data all over the place. Think of it like a Rubik's Cube, multiple dimensions. And that allows us then to come up with some scenarios. The scenarios are a way of exploring alternative futures. It's not meant to be predictive. It's just showing you some of the things that may happen. And it also allows us to model through mortgage stress, the price history trajectory, the buying and selling intentions, the migration data, people coming and going, and also the economic data. We can bang that into the core market model and through the scenarios. And at a postcode level, at a region, state, or Australia level, we can then form a view about what prices may do. Again, it's not a prediction, it's just a set of scenarios to help people consider alternative options. Now, of course, the first thing to talk about today is the RBA decision. No change, of course, but it was interesting them making a few points. They're going to maintain current policy settings. They did say that the economy is recovering better than expected, but the recovery is expected to be uneven and drawn out and remains dependent on significant policy support. In other words, more money, more quantitative easing. And they still think that it won't be until the end of 2021 that the level of GDP reaches the level attained back in 2019. So think of it like a long, slow dip. In the central scenario, the GDP is expected to grow by 5% next year and 4% over 2022. But remember, that's from a very low base, so it doesn't really tell you anything. And what it means is that we're going to have a smaller economy for quite some time. Employment growth was strong, they said, although the unemployment rate increased to 7%. Now, that's because more people are coming off JobKeeper, JobSeeker, and some businesses have opened. But we'll show you later the impact of that in terms of mortgage stress. It was quite surprising what's come through. Unemployment rates expected to go higher as businesses restructure. We're seeing that in spades, particularly among smaller businesses. And the unemployment rate, they say, is forecast to decline next year, but only slowly to around 6% at the end of 2022. So remember, we were higher than that. Sorry, we were lower than that before this all started, and we'll be higher in 2022. And they also suggest subdued increases in wages and prices over the coming period. Wage price index was very low, and the inflation forecast is also low. So not a real sign of any inflationary pressures at the moment on the official stats. We can discuss whether that's right or wrong, perhaps later on. And they also said that the high unemployment rate is very significant, and addressing it is a national priority. And then they wanted to say that the bank's policy response was to lower rates. We discussed that previously. They've bought $19 billion of government bonds and a further $5 billion of Australian government securities to support that three-year target. And the balance sheet at the RBA has gone up by $130 billion. Ah, mere bagatelle. That's pretty big. Monetary and fiscal support will be required for some time. And the board is not expecting to see the cash rate any higher for at least 3 years. So long, low rates. That's quite significant insofar that, of course, what it means is that we're going to see very low interest rates. We're going to see very low rates on savings and probably even lower mortgage rates ahead, which, of course, will be one of those factors which will also begin to drive home prices perhaps higher. And we'll discuss that later, particularly in the light of the CoreLogic data that's come out today and other sources that we have available. Now, just some other data points. Payroll was up a little. This is from data from the ABS today. So it gained, wait for it, 0.1%. And it's still down minus 2.9% since March the 14th. That was before the start of the lockdown. Victoria payroll lifted 1.1%. New South Wales slipped down minus 0.4%. It's been bumpy, but New South Wales is not looking very good. Queensland was flat, and WA eked out a modest 0.2% gain, and SA was flat. So there is a little bit of movement, but frankly, not a lot of real momentum. And of course, there's a debate about savings as well. People have put more money into savings, $13 billion more into savings in the 12 months to October 2020, despite record low interest rates, according to the article. And of course, the Reserve Bank, as I keep highlighting, says low rates can encourage some additional risk-taking as investors search for yield. That's a very important comment. In other words, don't leave your money in the bank, put it to use and take some risk. That's what the Reserve Bank wants. Of course, the risks that you may be taking could well be higher than you might think. So I still have a lot of people who are saying, no, I'm not going to do that. I still want the security and safety of money in the bank. Now, of course, yesterday, the deposit bail-in amendment bill didn't pass, didn't even get to vote on it. They voted about whether they were going to take a vote on it, and that's as far as it got. But nevertheless, very important discussion was had, and interestingly, there's now more and greater awareness of the whole question of deposit bail-in. So quite a few people talk to me about the risks and how to deal with them. Remember that everybody keeps referring to the 250k deposit guarantee scheme, but that's for a gone bank. Deposit bail-in is to support a bank, stop it from going bad. So the two things are not connected, despite the fact that everybody in Parliament still argues that it's connected. That's because they, of course, follow what Treasury says. Now, CoreLogic has said that dwelling values rose in November. And in fact, they make the point that regional home values are up 1.4% in November compared with 0.7% in capital city values. And in fact, regional Queensland led the rises in values, posting a 3.2% lift, followed by regional New South Wales. Now, we have seen some rises in our data. That's true, although I don't think it's necessarily as consistent as what CoreLogic is saying. But they did make the point also that across Sydney, there's a slightly stronger recovery trend in the upper quartile. Yeah, we're seeing that at the high end because many people there are not really exposed to some of the market risks, nor indeed do they need mortgages. The top 25% of values across Sydney remain, though, minus 2.5 lower than in March. Melbourne is also seeing a bit of upper quartile movement. Again, we're seeing that in some postcodes. Brisbane, there's been little difference in growth rates between the broad-based strata, with the upper quartile and the lower quartiles moving pretty much in the same. And Perth and Adelaide growth rates have been skewed towards the lower quartile over the quarter. Perth is moving up in places, and you can see there that the data is suggesting that on average it's over the month it's 0.8%. So, you know, that's what the CoreLogic data says. Now, of course, some of the information may be a little bit myopic based on the way that the models work, but this is, of course, very important because a lot of people derive a lot of information from what CoreLogic says. But this is a really interesting chart. This is actually from Westpac. And they showed that if you look at the distribution of price changes across Australia, it shows that 60% of the price falls over the last few months were in Melbourne. And most of that was more than 6%. Whereas 60% of the market in Brisbane recorded price gains, and 80% of price gains greater than 6% were outside the three major capital cities. So that again is another way of telling the same story about it is very much a regional story. And I'll explain a bit later what I think is going on there. Now, as a result of this, Westpac's revised their price forecasts. So they highlight that Melbourne, Sydney and the other major capitals are moving slightly differently from each other. And they do this funny thing where they do the three-month annualise, which tends to make it look even more significant than the growth rates are. But what they said was, we've recently marked up our price forecast with a 4% gain now expected in 2021 and a 10% rise in 2022, essentially bringing forward the previous forecast of a 15% surge that was going to start later. So another one basically comes onto the positive side of the ledger in terms of price growth. And of course, all of these things are taking account of the near-term data. But of course, there is a bunch of longer-term data as well. And I'm thinking of JobKeeper and JobSeeker beginning to run off. I'm beginning to think of the China situation. I'm thinking also of the fact that the virus is still raging in the US and in Europe. And are we going to open our borders? Well, we've allowed some students to come back into the Northern Territories as an experiment. If we're going to get more of that, we could well end up with more virus here. And of course, that then changes the game again. So it does depend very much on the scenarios you run with as to the likely outcome ahead, I think. Now, SQM also reported on listings today, and they reported a fall in old listings. SQM said that the national residential property listings decreased in November by 4%. That's down 12.6% compared to 12 months ago. And in fact, all capital cities recorded decreases in listings, with the exception of Melbourne, which recorded an increase. And Darwin, Sydney and Hobart posted the largest decreases of 6.7, 6.4 and 6.1. Brisbane recorded a decrease. Adelaide 3, Canberra 3.2. Perth recorded the lowest decrease. But they did go on to make the point that in fact there was a difference between new listings, which were up, and older listings, which were going down. Now, it's interesting because some of those older listings are coming off the market. That doesn't necessarily mean they've been sold. It simply means that people are actually just taking them off the market. We are actually seeing stronger new listings than previously. And that's being hidden in a lot of the information that a lot of people are talking about. And it's something which is very important to understand, because my expectation from my surveys is that we're going to see much higher listings, not before Christmas, but after Christmas in the new year. And if you saw the article that Tarek Brooker wrote for news.com over the weekend, that used my data and my survey data to highlight the fact that there were a lot of people, particularly with units, that would like to list for the first time in the new year. A lot of them were probably investors. So again, I think it's important to get really granular to see what's really going on. Now, the other point that came out today was from CoreLogic, and they highlighted the rental market divisions between houses and units. So capital city house rents were 0.7% higher in November, while unit rents were down 0.6%. But of course, that masks the much more considerable switches across different locations. You can see there that houses and units are behaving quite differently. But this is the really significant stuff. Units down 6.6% in Sydney and down 7.6% in Melbourne and 5.2% in Hobart. A lot of these are property investors. And so a lot of property investors are really going to experience significant problems with lack of cash flow because of this. One of the reasons why I'll show you that the mortgage stress for investment sectors were higher. And it's also worth highlighting that most of the weakness in rental market conditions was emanating from Melbourne and Sydney. Very significant falls there in the units. And there are about 500,000 units due to come on sale over the next few months, according to my survey. So expect to see more weakness as more property investors try to escape. Also, the ABS reported today a lift in dwelling approvals, and it was the fourth consecutive month of rises. Total dwelling approvals rose 3.8%. The total was really driven by largest increases in New South Wales, up 32.1%, and Western Australia, 29.7%. That was very much to do with houses. Approvals for private sector houses rose in Western Australia 37.5%, Queensland 9.4%, South Australia 5%. Meanwhile, there were falls in houses in Victoria down 6.9% and New South Wales down 4.2%. So you've got two factors. You've got the units still being approved and you've got houses. And of course, this is all to do with the government stimulus packages, particularly in Western Australia, where it's been very strong. And as I've said on a few occasions previously, the $55,000 to bring forward new homeland packages is having a significant impact in Western Australia. It's distorting the market quite considerably, lifted a lot of prices, and also has lifted the volume of transactions and activity. We're going to see more of that ahead, of course. So this is yet another example of the market being distorted by policy. Now, in terms of the lending data, the ADI data from APRA showed that in fact there was a slight rise of mortgage lending in October up by 5.8 billion. Most of it was for owner occupation, and the share of investment lending continued to fall. And interestingly, owner occupier lending rose 0.47%, investment rose 0.9%, so it went into positive territory just. And that gives a 0.33% overall rise for the banks. This is for ADIs. This is the bank's lending portfolio. This is the total portfolio value, of course. So it includes refinancing. It includes those paying loans. It includes those with loans being extended. And all of the other shenanigans, for example, with principal and interest repayment holidays, they're all in there. But there is slight growth. But this growth level is still very low. And as I'll show you later, the overall credit momentum is pretty weak. Now, the individual portfolio of lenders is quite interesting insofar that most of the growth this month came from ANZ and Commonwealth and Macquarie as well. ANZ was offering some very cheap deals and really is driving the lending quite hard. On the other hand, Westpac continues to dive and National Australia Bank continues to reduce its investment lending portfolio. The others are sort of moving a little bit up, a little bit down. ING is showing some further falls in investments, as is Suncorp, whereas Bendigo and Members Equity and Bank of Queensland grew their portfolios a little, although Bank of Queensland also dialed back their investments. So there's something interesting going on between two of the majors over this side who are very much leading the charge, and these two here, there's a different ball game. This is very significant, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. But of course, lending now, when rates are very low, may seem okay. The lending standards, by the way, are still a little bit tight in places, but many people are now getting debt to income ratios of 6, 7, and 8, no problem, which to me is very extended and could well lead to more problems later. Now, the RBA aggregates, which is everything, so this is all lending, banks and non-banks, overall, in the last month, moved a little, but didn't really sort of move very much at all. And you can see there that business lending is still relatively weak, as is personal lending. But really, take the aggregate 12-month view, and you can see there that overall housing lending is at 3.3. Now, it was 3.1% November to January. So it's moved up very slightly, but very, very little. There isn't really a lot of activity and momentum, really, despite all the low rates and despite all the other stuff that's going on. Within that, owner-occupier is up 5.4%, so that's a bit higher. That, of course, includes a lot of refinancing, including further drawdowns, and also people accumulating principal interest on their loans. Investment was down again, minus 0.3%, so still falling, although falling less. But personal credit was down 12.7% over the last year, and business was only 1.4% higher over the last 12 months. This is a very, very significant issue. This is a very low number. And this shows you that business lending and business investment is still pretty flat. That's one of the reasons why I've still got some doubts about the way things are going to play out ahead. Now look at broad money. That continues to go in the opposite direction to total credit. Total credit was just 1.8% over the last 12 months. Broad money's now 12.1%. So we've got all this liquidity, all this money printing, all of this pull down of superannuation, all of this principal interest repayment holidays, all the savings, very significant broad money, but it's not turning into credit growth. So you could argue, and I do argue in fact, that all of this stimulus isn't actually necessarily going into the real economy. It's not necessarily creating momentum amongst businesses. And whilst there's a little bit of momentum in the lending market for mortgages, it's not huge. This doesn't look to me to be an economy that is particularly well positioned to grow as strongly as the Reserve Bank is suggesting it might. Now let me talk about mortgage stress. So this was a surprise to me. I didn't expect mortgage stress to move higher, but it did. So we were at just over 40% last month, but it jumped up to 41.6% this month. Now you should be expecting, and I was expecting it to drop back, but it didn't. And when I looked at the data, what I discovered was three things. Firstly, we've got a lot of people come off JobKeeper, particularly from larger firms, but their incomes are actually still relatively limited compared with where it was. Secondly, we've got a lot of smaller firms who are going on to JobKeeper because their businesses are still very much struggling with what's going on. And so we actually had quite a rise in the number of small businesses who are actually in JobKeeper. And by the way, interestingly, if you look at the segmentation of the payroll data, it was the big end of town that actually was lifting their payroll. Actually, the small end of town, the SMEs, were continuing to reduce payroll overall. So that's consistent with what I'm seeing. The small business sector in Australia is under significant pressure at the moment. One of the reasons why mortgage stress is still rising. The third one is we've got more people now coming off those principal and interest repayment holidays and now having to start to make mortgage repayments, despite the fact their incomes are not what they were. In many cases, people are actually still earning considerably less or doing more part-time work. And so there is more pressure on households. Plus, of course, some of the renters are now beginning to have to start making rental repayments, and that's having a knock-on effect. And we're also still seeing a number of small businesses who are not able to pay and are not able to access JobKeeper. And I have a feeling that we're going to see more business failures over the next few months. There have been a significant number of business failures, a significant number of job losses. And that's one of the reasons why the Reserve Bank is right to assume that the unemployment rate is going to rise. That really explains what's going on here with the mortgage stress. Now, here is just the quick data snapshot. We'll just look quickly at mortgage stress first. So it's 41.6% across the total for Australia on average. Highest in Tasmania, still. Victoria at 45%. The ACT at 42.9%. And the Western Australia 44%. You can see there that there's some minor variations. Rental stress is also significant, particularly in New South Wales. A lot of issues here in New South Wales. 48% of households who are renting are having difficulty. Remember, I'm defining stress here as cash flow, money in, money out. How much money is coming in each month? Can I cover everything I need to cover? The bare necessities, things like council rates and rents and all those other things. And mortgages if I'm having to pay a mortgage, all of that stuff. So that's how I measure it. This isn't a set percentage. It's based on cash flow. So a lot of renters in New South Wales are really struggling. It's not so bad now in Victoria compared with where it was. Victoria's back down to 38. That's because of the lockdowns beginning to ease. WA's come down quite a bit too. But overall, Australia, it's 35% of people in rental stress. That's quite high. Not as high as mortgage stress, but pretty high. Now look at investor stress. 25.6% of investors are stressed. And again, it varies. ACT, 34%. New South Wales, 35%. The Victorians down at 25%. That's come back quite considerably, again, because of the change of circumstances in Victoria over the last month. But it's still very high. And overall financial stress, which measures the aggregate for all types of households, whether they're investors, renters, or mortgage holders, shows that the highest stress is in the ACT, New South Wales, and Victoria. So the two largest the two largest states plus the ACT, everybody else is there too, but overall 38.3%. So that's quite high. But this is a very big concern to me. 41.6, this should have gone down. If the economy was behaving the way that people were portraying it was behaving, it should have come down. It didn't come down. That's a big deal in my view. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next month, whether in fact there's a lag and then we start seeing it come back, or whether we're going to continue to see the unemployment pressures and the cash flow pressures and the underemployment pressures really flow through into continued stress. One of the reasons why I still predict the more people will have to sell their properties over in the new year. Now let's just quickly look at the various segments. This is another way of looking at the same data. And just quickly, these are our standard household segments. And you can see there that from a mortgage stress perspective, it's young growing families, including first-time buyers, who are right at the top of the list at 72%. You've then got the battling urban and disadvantaged fringe, so the people on the outer edge of our cities in those high growth areas at very high levels. And others are there too, exclusive professionals and young affluents at various stages. But also the suburban mainstream is there. And the multicultural, the first generation migrants are also experiencing it, and mature stable. This is touching many different household groups. If you look at rental stress, you can see there that mature stable and multicultural establishment, the first generation migrants, and stressed seniors and young affluents are all experiencing rental stress considerably. Investor stress is highest amongst exclusive professionals and young affluents. These are the people with multiple investment properties. They're highly leveraged. In many cases, they've got interest-only loans. And interestingly, in some cases, what I'm finding is that they've got a portfolio of properties with two or three that are now vacant. And that means then they're getting nothing at all in way of income from the rents. And that's creating significant pressure. And because they were highly leveraged to start with, because they were more affluent and therefore the banks were able to offer them more, they are the ones now in considerable difficulty at the moment. And so the overall financial stress footprint shows in pretty much all of the different segments, the ones on the edge of town, the fringe, the young affluents, the young growing family, first-time buyers, the multiculturals, and the exclusives as well. So wherever you look, we have segments of the market that are struggling. And this is important to understand, because whilst there is some good news out there for some, for others it's much less good. Now if I just quickly go through the mortgage stress postcodes, this is just listed from the number in mortgage stress. So it's actually a WA postcode, 6065, that's right at the top there. Places like Tapping, Wangara, Wanneroo. Then we go to places like Campbelltown with 10,000 again. That's 82% of households, and you'll see that in another slide I'll show you shortly. Then we go to Narre Warren, Fountain Gate in Victoria. Again, another high growth corridor with 9,400. Then we go to Berwick and Huckaway, a bit the same, 8,300. Then to Toowoomba with 8,200. Ballarat, so regional centre. Interestingly, there's some strange movements in prices, but nevertheless, a lot of stress too. 8,000 there at Ballarat. And then Pakenham, another high growth area. And then we go back to WA, to Tamala Park and Merriwa, places like that. And then we come back to Sydenham in Victoria, Roxburgh Park, Cranbourne, another high-growth suburb, and so it goes on. So there are some interesting characteristics when you start looking at these particular postcodes. Some of them are actually quite similar to each other. High-growth corridors, lots of new developments that were built quite quickly and sold at high full price with big mortgages, and now people are beginning to struggle with servicing those mortgages. Now we can then look at the rental stress postcodes, and right at the top is West Gosford, so that's up in the Central Coast at 9,000. Then we go to Greystanes and places like South Wentworthville and Westmead, areas like that, another 9,000 there. Then we go to Mount Druitt, places like that, Emerton, Bidwell, 8,800. Then we go to another New South Wales postcode up in Jarvis Bend, around that area. Then we go to the good old faithful Campbelltown. It seems to pop up quite often. And then we go to Blacktown. And then we go to Queensland. And that's Bundaberg up around there. Then we go to Bondi. Interestingly, Bondi is right up there. That's because there are a lot of people, young affluents in particular, who've got very significant issues with rents up and around there. Then we go to Parramatta. And so it goes on. So you can see some of the flavours. I will highlight that South Bank there is showing up, Victoria and South Yarra, places like that. And also places like Surrey Hill and Darlinghurst in New South Wales. And so it goes on. If I then go to the investors, the the postcode right at the top is Surfers Paradise. Highest proportion of stressed investors is 4,000 in Surfers Paradise. That's new, and that's because there's been quite a lot of buying quite recently. A lot of people are finding it's quite difficult. Well, then we go to Surrey Hills and Darlinghurst. Remember that this is where people live. Doesn't necessarily mean this is where they have property. Their investment properties could be other places. Then we go to Westmead. Then we go over to Western Australia, to Meadow Springs, and guess what? Mandurah. Yep, it's on the list once again, I'm afraid to say. So I'm afraid the story continues. Narraween, South Kilda, St Kilda South, I should say. And so it goes on. So again, you can see that some interesting mirrors as to where investor stress is. And you can also see that there's some differences. And then overall financial stress, this is the last slide on stress today. And guess where we start? We start at Campbelltown. Overall, there are more people in financial stress in terms of count in Campbelltown than anywhere else, than Toowoomba. Then we go to Lethbridge Park and places like that. Then we go to Greystanes and Wentworthville and Westmead. And then go to Cranbourne in Victoria. Then we go to Ballarat. Then we go to Gosford. And so it goes on. Fountain Gate, Narrawarren. These names are becoming quite familiar to me. I'm afraid to you too, perhaps. Point Cook, Werribee. We discussed that the other day, actually. Pakenham. So that's where a lot of the issues are. Now, there's another way that I can show you that. I'm just going to switch over to this little tool here. Okay. This is my stress mapping tool. I've just picked Melbourne to start with. And I'm just going to quickly show you what the mapping looks like. So this is now live data from my model, and you can see there that the orangey reddy stuff is the high levels of stress. So as we pull out from Melbourne, you can see that the stress levels are higher to the north, higher also down towards Dandalon and that area, big areas around here. And there are other places where it is less significant as you pull further out. Ballarat comes into view. The point I want to make is that this is very much a patchwork quilt, you know. You've got to look at individual places. You can't just look at one postcode. You've got to look at what's going on. And I think what's interesting is, I can't smell Sydney. Sorry about that. Try that. I'm just going to switch to Sydney and do the same thing. Okay, so this is Double Bay, Woollahra, very high levels of stress. A lot of that is to do with large leverage property. And as you pull out from Sydney, you can see that, you know, on the inner suburban area, it's not looking too bad. There's a few hot spots, but nothing too bad. You know, Rose Bay is looking particularly good. But as you pull out further, you can begin to see some slightly different pictures. And what's interesting about this is that as you come out further and further, you can begin to see the patterns again. So if you look out towards the north, let's pull that up there, you can see that around the areas here, there's quite a lot more stuff going on. Some of the regional centres, orange is not looking too good at the moment. And if you pull back in slightly further, you can see there that places like Maitland and some of the areas north of Sydney, also Upper Hunter as well. So this is just a way of trying to highlight the way that things are going. I might just do one more. Let me just do the Gold Coast and around there, because I think that's quite an interesting one to look at. There you go. Okay, so this is the Gold Coast now. And we start sort of close in, not looking too bad. But as you come out, you then start to see signs of some issues. It's not uniformly bad, but you can also see that there are definitely areas that are quite hot spotty. And as you come up towards Brisbane, you can see again that there are particular areas in and around Brisbane that actually have some significant issues. Of course, we go west towards the Lockyer Valley, and there are issues there, Toowoomba and places like that as well. This is quite a powerful way of just showing you where things are. Now, what's interesting is that there's quite a strong correlation between these sorts of postcodes and what's happening with home prices and particularly sales momentum. So there is an interesting correlation between the stress data and everything else. Okay, I'm just going to finish off my part of the show here by just going back now to the scenarios. And just to explain, as I've done before, scenarios are a way of looking at the different futures. It's not a prediction. It's just showing you what's going on. But these are the scenarios as at now. So what I've done is basically the model has spat out a higher probability now of the best case with a COVID vaccination. So it's now a 35% probability compared with 30% last time. That's getting pretty close. If it goes slightly higher, then that becomes my predominant scenario. At the moment, my longer-term crunch is 40%, so that's still slightly higher. And we've made some changes there to the scenarios in that particular example as well. The multi-wave disruption is still there on the list, but if we can get the virus under control, then this is less likely. So we're looking here in this sort of area. In other words, there is a path for higher home prices, not necessarily for everywhere, perhaps for houses in some locations. But I also think that the longer-term crunch, the mid-case scenario, as I call it, is still slightly ahead at the moment. But maybe by next month, it will actually have reversed. And if it does, that will have a significant impact on the individual households and individual scenarios that we run with. Okay, so that's, I think, enough there. What I'm going to do now is just have a little look at some of the information, and I can also hopefully pull up my postcode tool. So we've got the postcode tool running. Yes, we have. So this is the postcode tool as it currently stands. This will be available shortly. What we're going to do is use this tool. We're moving it from sort of alpha to beta. And in fact, the first beta users will be those who, through our Patreon program, subscribe to our stress data. You'll be given the chance quite soon to access information directly. I've just put in 2,000 to start with. And just to give you a bit of a flavor, you've got, again, all the stress information by the households, those borrowing, those renting. You've got also the mortgage stress information, the financial stress top line metric, the mortgage stress metric, the rental stress metric, 60% in 2000, and the investor stress metric. And then you've got our three scenarios. So best case, longer term crunch, and multi-wave. And you can see there that the best case is suggesting prices could rise for houses over the next year or two. Units slightly more negative, but then moving positive. So that is essentially the snapshot that we get. And I see there that the new voice has said 3036. So why don't we go with that to see whether I can get that 3036. Now, we have to select a postcode to make it work. Otherwise, we break it. Did that work? Let's have a look. 3036. I mistyped it. Unfortunately, the program doesn't actually deal with my poor computing skills. There you go, typing skills. There we go, 3036. Okay, 3036. Okay, so 2,000 households, 900 borrowing, 600 renting. Overall financial stress, 70%. That's very low. Mortgage stress at 70% is also low. Default rates at 3%. And rental stress is similar. And the overall investor stress at 18. So there's a relatively low level of stuff going on. And you can see there that our estimation is that if the best case scenario is right, then houses could be on the rise with about 5% over 3 years. On the other hand, units, 9%. So basically there's some upside there. But if you follow the other two scenarios and my main scenario, then there's a little bit of a slide. So that's that one. And I'm just going to try this. Let me see whether I can make this work. Just a moment. Let's try this little trick here. If I push that. Yay, it worked. Eureka. We're back. All right, Otto wanted 2206. So let me try and put 2206 in over here and see whether I can make it work. 2206. As I say, you'll soon be able to have access to this tool directly, and then you can look it up yourself. So this is 2206 Otto. I'll take that off now so you can see it. Okay, this is Clem Park and Ullwood. 7,000 households, 2,600 borrowing, 2,000 renting, 1,700 properties for rent, and 2,000 rental property owners. 33% in financial stress, so that's sort of middle of the road. 16% in mortgage stress, not too much trouble there, but 58% in rental stress, so that's quite a big deal. And 581 stressed investors, with a few severely stressed investors at 32%. And you can see there that the trajectory is some potential rises if you take my best case scenario, but my mid case is suggesting slight falls, not dramatic falls, but slight falls, both for units and for houses over the next year or so. Okay, what else have we got? Let's see what else we can find. Footscray, somebody said. Let's see if I can find that. Okay. In Rock, put up Footscray. 3011. See, I have to select it, otherwise it doesn't work. Okay. Footscray. Okay. Financial stress at 56%. Let me just take this one off so that we can actually read it. Cool, just heard a thunderclap. 10,000 households, 2,000 borrowing, 6,000 renting, 5,000 properties for rent, and 56% in financial stress. Mild stress, 58% of households, 4% in defaults, that's quite high. 46% in rental stress, 41% of investors stressed. So that's why we are suggesting that prices could slide over the next year, even in the best case scenario, down 3 in the best case or 9 in the mid case, but then recover over the following couple of years. So that's a more negative postcode than some. Now this is an interesting comment. Let me just pick this one up. Go back to there as well. I think the biggest law in the scenarios is that things will be better with a vax. Well, look, yeah, let's just assume, as I have in my scenarios, that the vax does work and it does help to iron out the kinks, as it were. Now, there's no guarantee, of course. It's still early days, but some of the early results look reasonably positive. So that's why I'm using that as one of my cornerstones. And in fact, if you look at the way that the Reserve Bank is thinking, and other people too, they're all thinking that the virus will get under control quite soon, early next year, and that will actually allow things to happen quite quickly. So it is critical. It's a linkage. Now, you know, if you don't agree, then just go with my other scenarios. Because my mid case, the longer term crunch, is one where the vaccine process doesn't work. It takes a lot longer, and therefore we have to deal with this for a much longer period. That's why scenarios are important, right? Because you can basically run whichever way you want. But there's no doubt in my mind that getting the vaccine sorted is a critical path to getting the virus sorted, which is a critical path to getting the economy sorted. So that's how I see it. But, you know, you can agree or disagree. That's fine. That's the beauty of this sort of conversation, right? You don't have to agree with me. Okay, here's one from... Okay, Natalia. Can I do 2099? Hopefully I can. Let's have a go. Oops. Okay. Let's look it up first. If it works. There we go. Let's get rid of that too so you can read it. Okay, so this is places like North Curl Curl, DY. 16,600 households, 6,000 borrowing, 7,000 or 8,000 renting with... 6,000 investors. 58% is the financial stress metric, so that's quite high. The financial stress relating to mortgages is 37%, so that's sort of lower than some. 49% of rental stress. Rental stress is still a thing. And 60% of investors are stressed. So there's still some issues there with regard to the investors. And even in my best case, I'm still thinking that prices will slide a bit next year before they come back. My mid case, which is, as I explained, the one which I think is most likely to happen, is sort of a bit of a fall. And you can see there that units are also looking to drop even more. I do think that units generally consistently are going to underperform relative to houses in most places. And I think this one would be an example of that. All right, let's have a look down the list. Okay, let's go here and have a chat about China. So this is a one from Adeline. Do you have any thoughts on China trade problems' influence on Aussie finances? Yeah, I think it's a big deal. We know something like about 12% of exports are potentially impacted by what's going on with regard to the current China situation, 12%. Now, you know, they're still taking the iron ore, and they're still taking the coking coal because China needs it. So that's still a very large proportion. So WA may be doing okay. But for other sectors, particularly those, for example, in the agricultural sector, they are definitely in some difficulty. And of course, the government mentioned today they are considering additional financial measures to support some of those particular sectors. Now, they also did say that just because they impose, you know, 200% tariffs doesn't mean they can't necessarily still sell. It's just they won't be able to sell as much, and they are looking for other markets. But I think this is a big deal. I think that the whole economic question here is pretty important. You know, one of the things that we'll talk about perhaps is the trade statistics and how that translates into GDP numbers a bit later, because I think that's quite an important statistic. I think it's a big deal. I quite like that one. Let's put that one up. So T. Dang says, if vax doesn't work, we just print more money. Indeed. And, you know, I did a post the other day with Tarek that basically said we've got 1.8 trillion reasons why house prices will still rise, right? Because we just go and print, print, print. The question is, if the liquidity doesn't go anywhere, and I showed you the issue with regard broad money and credit, if it doesn't go anywhere, then you can create all this liquidity. It doesn't necessarily create momentum in the real economy, and that's the problem I see. And whilst they can go on supporting through JobKeeper and JobSeeker extensions and continuing with the principal interest repayment holidays, by the way, the latest data shows that more people are now starting to repay, but there's also this very important cohort that is unable to start repaying. They can extend that, but all of these are just creating more issues for later. It doesn't solve the fundamental issues that we have in the economy. So that's my problem. I can see that we're going to go on and on through this process. Printing isn't necessarily the answer. It hasn't proved to be the answer in Europe or in Japan or indeed in the US. But of course, with Biden likely to come in to the US with Janet Yellen also now going to be leading the Treasury, expect more dovish behaviour, expect more liquidity printing in the US too. Okay, let's find another one to do, shall I? There's a lot of conversations, I can't necessarily see all of them, but I'm going to do 3156. So I'm just going to leave that up while I put 3156 in. Okay, look it up. Yeah, it's working. Okay. Get rid of that so you can see it. 14,000 households. This is in Ferntree Gully, Mountain Gate, Upper Ferntree Gully. So it's sort of out, east of Melbourne. 8,000 borrowing, 3,000, 4,000 renting, 3,000 plus properties for rent, nearly 5,000 investors. 47% is the financial stress metric, so middle of the road. 35% in mortgage stress, not too bad. 71% in rental stress, and that's another example. I keep seeing this in these high growth corridors, a lot of rental stress. And that's because many people are still actually dealing with much lower levels of income than they used to. And of course, some of the rental repayment holidays will soon come to an end. 27% in investor stress, so it's not too bad. Rental stress is the issue, but it'll flow through. And that's why we still see negative scenarios for prices over the next 12 months or so in this particular postcode. Coming back a bit, but not as much as some others over the next little while. Okay. Hus 478-3156. I did 3156. So your pleading worked. How about that? What else have I got? Okay. Christina wanted another. Put that one up there. There you go. Can you look at 2203 or 3130? Oh, two. Well, I'm not sure I can do two, but let me do 2203. Oops. Dulwich Hill. All right. Get rid of that. Okay, so 6,000 households, 2,000 borrowing, 3,000 plus renting, 2,500 properties for rent, and 60% in financial stress, 28% in mortgage stress. Some severe stress, though, that's not too good. 2% defaults, 58% in rental stress, and 68% in investor stress. So investor stress is a thing. Not surprising, actually, in the inner suburban area. We're often seeing that. As a result of that, you can see there that both units and houses are looking like a slight fall before they rise, perhaps in 2022. All right. Jason, I appreciate that contribution. Thank you so much. Should have mentioned Fitzroy 3065. 3065. Did I do that one? 3065. Fitzroy. I'm not sure I did Fitzroy, but anyway, if I didn't, I'll do it now. Fitzroy? Okay. Maybe I didn't. 5,000 households, just over 1,000 borrowing. 3,500 renting, so a very rental-heavy sector, of course. Nearly 3,000 properties, 38% in financial stress, 59% in mortgage stress, so that's significant. 22% in rental stress, not too bad. 43% in investor stress. So again, it's a bit of a combination. It's a sort of a mix. 38% is quite low relative to other postcodes in Victoria. I was looking at one the other day that was double that, so it doesn't look too bad. Nevertheless, likely small falls over the next 12 months before a rise in 24 to 36 months' time, with units looking like a more significant fall. And in fact, the worst-case scenario could see units down 27% if we got that recurring virus. My sort of mid-case is more like 12% down over 3 years. So that's that one. Dean, thank you for that. 4817. Okay. All right, so that's places like Alice River and Kirwan. 11,500 households, of which 5,400 borrowing, 5,000 are renting. There's about 4,000 properties for rent, and stress is overall 22%. That's pretty low, isn't it? 26% in mortgage stress, 14% in rental stress, 10% in investor stress. And as a result of that, my expectation is that prices, if you take my best case scenario, could well rise over the next 12 months. That's 5%, and then 8.6, this is cumulative, and then a slight slide. Units also looking positive as well. And even in my longer term crunch, it's pretty much line ball, slight rise, slight fall. So this is one where I think prices are more on the upside than many others. Now, let's have a little look here. Let's see if I can get that one sorted out. Okay, interesting question. I'm going to put this one up. Well, it's interesting. The thingy is still working. So just to explain, the application that I use was upgraded, quote unquote, some months ago and completely failed. I've been wrestling with the developer for some time. They finally got it fixed. The only way to make it work, though, is to use a separate screen, which is why I'm now looking over there rather than over here when I'm actually pulling it up. But nevertheless, it is quite good to have the question on the screen, isn't it? This is from Phil. How would a massive drop in the Aussie dollar to US affect interest rates? Would government still be able to keep control given borrowed in US dollars? Same for New Zealand. So I think it's a very good question. And, you know, it's interesting that the Reserve Bank wants a lower exchange rate. They've said that quite consistently. It was one of the reasons why they took the rates down. The idea was if you take rates down, then you're going to reduce the international demand. And that means that essentially the exchange rate could move the right way. Unfortunately, it's gone the wrong way. It's at 73, 74. And that means we import deflation, not inflation. It also means that we've still got quite a lot of interest from foreign parts in terms of into Australia. So in a way, it sort of supports some parts, but of course it makes our exports go the wrong way. Idea of a lower is to make our exports cheaper, right? So it's not necessarily working well. And I actually think that the real question is not what's going to happen to the Aussie dollar, it's what's going to happen to the US dollar. And there's a big debate going on at the moment as to whether whether the US dollar is going to stay strong or whether it's going to collapse. And in fact, I discussed this over the last couple of weeks with a number of different people, and go and look at the shows, including Harry Dent and a few others as well, who have different sides of the debate on strong US dollar or weak US dollar. In other words, will the US dollar remain a currency of last resort, or will it be replaced by something else? That's a very important question. My sense is with Biden coming in, it's more likely that it will be positioned as a currency of last resort. It will stay strong. That could have a significant impact then in terms of the exchange rate here. The Reserve Bank would love a weaker exchange rate. They have said that they might even consider market interventions later, but they haven't done that so far. And I think that would be a bit awkward if they did that. So my own sense is they're probably just hoping it's going to go weaker, but it may go stronger, which won't necessarily be very good. Jason says, another great, good show. Cheers, Martin. Thanks, Jason. I really appreciate that. I do like comments, particularly when they like what I do. I mean, do my best. I really do my best. It's quite challenging working all these various things and trying to get all the information out as we go. Now, let's have a look at another postcode. Mark wanted 2227. 2227. 2227. Okay, Gaimia. Gaima? Is that right? Yeah. Begin to learn these postcodes. Just going to have a quick sip of water if I may while I'm just doing this. Okay, 5,600 households, 2,600 borrowing, 1,600 renting, 1,200 properties for rent, and 46% in financial stress, with mortgage stress at 26%, rental stress at 57%, and investor stress at 49%. And you can see there that we're thinking that there will be a bit of a fall followed by a bit of a sort of straight line view. If your best case scenario is true, then a very minor fall and then a recovery. With units, a bit the same. Definitely a path, if the vaccine really is as effective as people hope it will be, to see property prices rising over the next 2 or 3 years. My mid case is slightly under the water at the moment. I can see a few interesting and challenging questions coming up there. Good show. Just going to acknowledge Bondi Steve, a regular. Hi, Steve. Hope you're well. Nice to see you on, and thanks for spending the time with us. Been around for a few years now on my channel. Good to see you being loyal and popping up. Great. Thank you. And Vanessa makes a very interesting point. China has a dollar shortage problem. Yeah, well, it's very interesting because, of course, they are actually unwinding some of their US investments, and that includes bonds. They are trying to repatriate a lot of liquidity back to China. One of the reasons why some of the people with Chinese money here in Australia is putting it back to China. I think we're going to see more of that. There was also more evidence of banks being bailed out in China, and you know, all of those things look to me as though they're going to be more wobbliness in China. The economics there may not be as strong as perhaps we think it is. That could be a big deal. Okay, what else have we got? Just going to load a few more comments. Yeah, you see, it's very interesting because the little tool has just died again. So there you go. They haven't fixed it. The issue is, I think, there's a capacity issue, right? So they can allow it to show a few conversations, but I think probably what happens then is it just gets too many. And if I then try to restart it, the whole thing just falls over. So it really is not totally reliable. I may well have to find another way of doing it. Let's try that, see whether it comes back. Okay. Right. I've managed to make it come back. But you shouldn't have to reset in the middle of a show. I mean, that's just crazy, isn't it? So it's not working right yet. This is from Julia. Could you please do 4037? Also, do you have any comments on the flood of New South Wales, Victoria buyers to Queensland? Yes, let me talk about that once I've done 4037. Eaton's Hill. Let me just put that up so you can see it and get rid of that so that it's not in the way. Okay, 2,500 households, 1,900 borrowing, 469 renting, 32% in financial stress, 21% in mortgage stress, that's 401, and 50% in rental stress. A bit of rental stress, not much there going on. That's quite a relatively low number, and you can see there that, again, on the best case scenario, definitely potential rises in both units and houses in that postcode. Now, the other part of your question was the flood of New South Wales, Victorian buyers. Yeah, there's definitely some evidence of that. I did that in my recent surveys, and I think there's net about 4,000 net towards from Victoria to Queensland, and about 2,500 from New South Wales to Queensland intending to buy up in Queensland. Now, whether that will turn around because of the fact that the lockdowns are now going away and the borders are open, this was at the time when people were essentially having to buy sight unseen, and some people were doing that simply to be able to relocate or buy investment property up there. There has been a bit of investment property bought, but you know, my data suggests a lot of that is actually quite stressed investment property at the moment. And we're certainly seeing some momentum, positive momentum in some areas of Queensland. We're also, though, seeing significant pressure on other areas. And some of the recent shows that I did highlighted the fact that there were significant falls in some areas, for example, north of Cairns. So it's not a uniform situation in Queensland. But nevertheless, I think, yeah, net positive to Queensland from Victoria and New South Wales at the moment. Okay, what else have we got? Broome says somebody here. Let's pick that one up. Okay. 6725. Okay, 5,700 households, 1,000 borrowing, 3,600 renting, and financial stress is 11%, very low. Very little mortgage stress at 6%, almost no rental stress, and 21% of investors stress. So it doesn't look too bad to me over there at the moment. And with positives potentially on the better scenarios for price movements and the positive direction. Very small sampling, of course, because it's quite a small postcode, so just be a little bit careful on that. But I suspect that we're going to see a little bit more there. Oh, hang on. What I didn't do was that. Let me do that again. 5,700, 1,000 borrowing, 3,600 renting, 11% in financial stress, 17% in mortgage stress. Oh, this is interesting. I missed this the first time. 6% in default. Now, that's quite significant. Now, that's based on past trends. And that's based on real data from a number of lenders that I actually use data with. So that's concerning. 4% in rental stress, 21% in investor stress. So it looks to me as though at the margin there's an issue, but overall financial stress is quite low there at the moment. Okay. Yeah, you have to be a bit persistent with there are so many questions and so many queries that are coming up that I don't necessarily see all of the comments. It's just one of those things. This is an interesting one. Maria said, where's Cookie Boy? Well, he was there earlier on because he made a couple of interesting comments. Not sure where he's gone to now, but he was definitely there earlier on. Okay, what else have we got? South Oz, says Cameron. Great show, Martin. Can we see South Oz 5022? Give it a go. Let's bang it in, switch it over, switch it off. There you go. Okay, 7,300 households. This is in Grange, Henley Beach, and Tennyson. 2,500 borrowing, 3,000 renting, just over 2,400 properties for rent, and financial stress is at 20%. The mortgage stress is at 26%, and defaults at 3%, with rental stress at 12%, and investors rest at 22%, so not particularly high. And so what I'm suggesting there is even in my mid scenario, there isn't going to be much of a fall. If you take the more positive view, it could be a rise in prices over the next couple of years, both for units and for houses. Let's put this one up. Quite interesting conversation there from Animus. If the US dollar keeps falling, then it's going to be cheaper to buy gold in Australia. But if the US dollar falls off a cliff, you could see government step in to devalue the Aussie dollar. Yeah, that's right. The thing is, my own view on all of this is that there is sort of an equation between our local dollar and the US. It tends to track quite closely. And the problem is everybody's sort of producing more liquidity and trying to effectively manipulate. It's not like it was previously where one particular currency was effectively trying to devalue itself against. Everybody's sort of playing the same game. So it becomes then a question of who can play the game better. And I think the Fed can probably play it better than we can. They've got more capacity to continue to create liquidity. And of course, with Biden in, chances are that Biden will do more in the way of printing and liquidity and all those sorts of things later. That's my own view. Could be wrong. Although, you know, it's hard to quite see how this is all going to play out because there are so many moving parts. But that's how I'm seeing it at the moment. Let me put this one up. This is from Michael. Thanks for your hard work. Do you see any reason why the RBA could raise interest rates again? Well, they've said clearly they're not going to raise rates at least for 3 years. And the problem I've got is we've got into the situation now where the size of the government debt is so big they can't afford to allow rates to rise. So they are going to keep the rates very low for as long as possible. Now, the question will be, will inflation come through? If inflation starts to come through, they may be forced to react. Typically, what you would do then is lift rates. But if they can't lift rates because it would increase the cost of debt. And they also know that many households would fall into significant pressures much more than today. So I think they've locked themselves into this very low rate environment. And my own modelling is suggesting this could be low for 5 to 8 years. Look at the UK. UK took rates down in 2010 or thereabouts, and they've still got them in that rate span now. Look at Japan. They're in negative rates, and they've been there for a long time. You see, it's a one-way street. I can't find a way back. So I don't think it's highly likely that rates are going to rise anytime soon. Now, the only thing that might tip that is if we start seeing the bond markets beginning to move in a different direction. And there were a few signs quite recently of the bond market beginning to wake up in the US. I'll be interested to see what Steve Van Meter says about this next time I speak with him. But I think in the short term, there's no chance. In the medium term, there's very little chance. And my own view is we should expect rates to stay low for, frankly, a generation. That's killing savers, of course. And one of the things I keep coming back to is, what do savers do, right? I mentioned earlier on, there is more money sitting in savings accounts than probably ever. And that's simply because people are very concerned about what's going on and want to protect themselves, quite justifiably. And yet the Reserve Bank is saying, well, you should put money into market exposure situations to get better returns. Well, it's so easy for them to say, but many people don't want to do that, which basically then says, well, then I'm going to take very, very low returns on my savings. It's very unlikely that we're going to see that change anytime soon. And what that basically means is that people have to shrink the amount that they spend. And this is why I get very cross, because, of course, a lot of people argue that, well, mortgage rates are down, that's great, because it's going to drive the housing price higher, it's going to drive more people to buy more property. But there's 3 million plus of people who are reliant on income from savings, and they're the ones who are taking the brunt. They're the silent majority in many ways. And I'm very concerned that both politicians and our regulators are fixated on debt and fixated on mortgages and completely forget this very important segment of the population, many of whom have done the right thing and saved through their lives, and are now finding that the savings that they had are not able to support them in the lifestyle that they want. That's a big deal. All right, let's do another postcode. Catherine asked for 3079. 3079. Ivanhoe in Victoria. Let's get rid of that and put that up. There you go. 6,700 households, 2,400 borrowing, 2,700 renting, just over 2,000 properties for rent, and financial stress at 35%. Mortgage stress at 74%, that's a big deal, quite a high number. That's probably the highest we've seen today. Default rates at 2%. Rental stress at 15%. Investor stress at 13%. So it's all about mild mortgage stress and the 74%. Quite a few people here still have principal interest payment holidays. and will be struggling when they have to start paying up again later in the year. As a result of that, it looks to me as though we're going to see some falls, but then prices perhaps recovering a bit later. But that does that is predicated on what you think with regard to the lockdown or not, the virus or not. Okay, lots and lots. Mark says, I react positively to a plea, Mark. Very good. 3193. This place like Chroma. Look it up. Get rid of that. There we go. Oh, sorry. That shouldn't have been there. That was from a previous show. I pushed the wrong button. My apologies. 8,000 households. 3,000 borrowing. 2,000 renting. 1,700 properties for rent. 37% in financial stress. 26% in mortgage stress, but 6% defaulting. So there's a high default rate here. That's to do with the financial pressures that we're seeing. And some rental stress, some investor stress, 56%. So that's why the stress metric is at 37. And again, we're seeing prices on the downside over the next year or so before they perhaps recover a little. This is an interesting comment from Julia. Been saving for 20 years, a waste of time at this point. You're spot on, better off buying a property and not paying rent. 50% drop in price wouldn't even bother me. Well, there are a lot of people who would argue the same. And I think there's an interesting question here. So if you basically start from the assumption that it is no longer relevant and appropriate to just stick money in the banks, what do you do? Well, there are people going crypto, of course, and crypto's been up and down, 6% fall, 6% rise. I still think crypto is pretty speculative. There are other people thinking gold, but I think that a lot of people will be disappointed. The gold price is coming back rather than going forward, so gold is pretty much out of it, which then takes you to property versus market exposure. Now, you know, you may have be aware I've tied up with Nucleus Wealth. We've got the What the World Fund and What the World Super as a way of allowing people to access market exposure and try and get some returns above deposits and, you know, avoid the bail-in. So that's one option. The other one is property. The thing about property is, yeah, you may not get much capital growth over the medium term. It's probably going to be sideways or slightly up over 5 to 10 years. Nothing like we had over the last 30 years. On the other hand, it doesn't seem to me we're going to see massive falls at the moment with all the liquidity, the 1.8 trillion from government sources and everything else that's gone into the system. So there is some underlying support. But remember this, property is overvalued by 40% in real terms. And that means we're on a very high plateau with very high leverage, with very high debt, which leaves us very vulnerable. And that's the problem I've got. So in my scenarios, you know, even my worst case scenarios, I'm not looking now necessarily for a 40% fall in prices, unless things go really, really bad. I'm thinking there'll be some adjustment down, but the changed environment that's been created by government printing and the Reserve Bank's liquidity processes, all that sort of stuff, basically puts a floor on property. So in that case, you can make an argument for holding and buying property. Even if rents are actually under pressure, many property investors are actually seeing rents falling. Many property investors have higher vacancy rates than they've ever had before. And that's one of the reasons why there's 500,000 property investors looking to sell in units, particularly over the next couple of years. I'd also make this point. If you are going to buy property, I would avoid units. I'd go for houses. And I'd look at perhaps some of the regional centres and some of the areas outside the major cities of Sydney and Melbourne, because I think there are going to be more issues there. I think other places are going to do better. So that's sort of my own sort of formulation as to what strategies might be there. But then you've got to just bear the in the back of your mind, there is a risk sometime that prices could begin to fall quite dramatically. The Harry Dent scenario could still play out if, in fact, the US goes the way he thinks it's going to go. I'm not as convinced of that in the current environment. I think all this liquidity will keep this balloon in the air for quite some time. So we've got a low, low interest rate environment. We've got some market opportunity for market exposure, or we've got property. Those seem to me to be the two options now. And some will go one way, some will go the other way, some will actually have a mixture of both. And sometimes a mixture of both may make the most sense. Now, Cookie Boy put an interesting response, which is, so, hi, Cookie Boy. If property was less than 5x income, then Julia is right. Otherwise, no, invest the dough elsewhere. Well, you see, that's my position, Cookie Boy. I think that property is still overvalued. I think the underlying fundamentals are such that it is going to be quite risky to really get exposed to property at this stage in the game. I mean, I have a property, but I don't have any debt against it. But, you know, people make their own minds and should make their own minds up. The thing is, make an informed decision, right? So basically, what I'm trying to do on this channel is to put the different pros and cons and different options and choices out there, rather than saying that there is a definitive, simple answer. There isn't, right? There is no such thing as a risk-free investment. There's no such thing as, the silver bullet solution here. You've got to muddle through. Step one is to think through what you think the Reserve Bank is going to do and what the scenarios are going to be like ahead. Step two is to think about your risk profile. And then step three is to actually begin to construct a strategy around it. At least that's what I do. So that's how I think about it. Right, what else have we got? Let's go there. This is from Dennis. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Sutherland 2232. Interesting postcode, Sutherland. I've been doing quite a lot of work on Sutherland. Watch this space for a future show on Sutherland. Okay, here we go. Let's put this up. Get rid of that. And thanks for your support too, I should say. 13,000 households, 6,000 borrowing, 4,000 renting, 3,000 properties for rent, and around 3,000 property owners. 43% in financial stress, so middle of the road, slightly high. Not a huge amount of mortgage stress at 27%. Bit of default, not a lot. But 60% in rental stress, and that's the problem. That's the Achilles heel for this particular postcode. Seen it, quite a few properties are not actually getting rent, and therefore the investors, 44% of investors are stressed. That's a big deal. And I have a feeling that we will see some further corrections in the area. Although you can see there, that the mid case is looking at a 5 or 6% fall over 3 years for houses, for units down 9%. The best case scenario is plus 4.4 or plus 7.3. So you pay your money and you takes your choice, I guess. It's an interesting one from Cameron. Australian property is overvalued, yes. I've shifted to the US rental houses, which are easier to purchase, cash outright, no debt, but with solid cash flows. It's working for me. Very interesting, Cameron. I know a number of people who actually have given up on investing in property in Australia and are investing internationally. Of course, there's the question of the exchange rate risk and how you deal with that. But actually, it may make some sense. And in fact, the US markets, I mean, what's fascinating about the US market is that the overall level of property, relative to income, is just so much lower. So it's a completely different ballgame. I mean, people are surprised when I point out just how cheap property is, even in some of the more prestigious areas in the US relative to here. Just be clear, we are totally over-leveraged into property. We have some of the highest debt ratios in the world. The government and the Reserve Bank is encouraging people to put more money into property to try and support the economy. But we're just making the debt bubble even bigger. We're making the property crisis even larger. And anybody who's not got property yet but wants to buy is going to have to be leveraged to the hilt to do it. I expect to see more schemes, like more first home buyer schemes. I expect to see shared ownership schemes come through. Lots of other strategies to try and drag forward more people into the property sector. But we are over-leveraged. It is a significant issue for me, but none of the politicians want to deal with this critical issue. Okay, this is one from The Stranger. Where is the least volatile region to buy a house or home, either capital or large region? Don't care for capital gain, but don't want a huge drop. Well, at the moment, Queensland is where I'd be looking. I think that Hobart was quite good. South Australia was quite good, but there are some wobblies there. Queensland looks to me to be the area. I wouldn't go directly for the areas around the Sunshine or Gold Coast. I'd look to slightly further back or slightly away from there. But there seems to be some solidity. The reason I say that is that prices in Queensland did not run up since 2012, 13, 14, unlike in Sydney and Melbourne and many other areas. So we haven't had the run up. So prices relative to income are much cheaper, more stable. There is positive demand and positive migration. I'm assuming that the international borders will eventually get open, and that means that we'll get tourism back because tourism in Queensland is so critically connected. But in the meantime, it looks to me as though the Queensland economy will be supported by significant state debt. They announced today significant rises in debt. So basically, I think that's where the answer lies. I wouldn't touch Melbourne, particularly units in Melbourne. I think that's going to go through a very significant transformation on the downside. Houses in Sydney and Melbourne, maybe, but the rental returns don't look flash relative to Queensland. The net yields in Queensland are about twice what they are in Sydney and Melbourne. And the vacancy rates are also a lot lower. So that's where I'd look. Would I look at Perth? That's the other area. People have said to me, oh, Perth's the place to go now. And in fact, I did a show over the weekend that where the Western Australian REA basically said, oh, you know, next year it's going to be another stellar year, right? They've said that for the last 5 years, by the way. I'm less certain about Perth for the reasons that it's a very narrowly based economy. And if the iron ore thing goes off the boil, that's a significant risk. And also, whilst there are some areas over in Perth where prices are moving up a little, there are lots of areas where they're still significantly down. Mandurah, Kamakia, I mean, down 38% from peak, and not much happening down there. So, yeah, Queensland is where I'd look. Okay, well, it's 9:29. Goodness me, didn't that go quick? I have to say that I probably haven't done as many as I'd like to. 3844, which is that one, because there's an interesting question behind that. 3844. Okay, this is one from G2, who said, 3844, I need to settle arguments with colleagues that Traingeron property market is booming. Let's have a look, shall we? Is it booming? Well, depends on your definition. 52% of people in financial stress in the postcode, 12,000 people, 5,000 borrowing, 5,000 renting, number of property investors nearly 3,000, 70% in mortgage stress, doesn't look like it's booming to me, 70% in mortgage stress, 3% in default over the next 12 months, 43% in rental stress, 22% in investor stress, and even in my most bullish scenario, prices likely to fall over the next year, recover maybe in 2 years. Whereas my mid-case, they are still 7 houses down 8% over 3 years or units down 13%. This is not a booming postcode. So you can tell your colleague just that. Okay, now let me just go back to this other thing. I just wanted to talk before I finish tonight about the balance of payments. We had the goods and services surplus data today, which showed that there was a rebound in imports, but exports fell further. Tomorrow we get GDP. I think it's going to be around 3% recovery. Remember, this is down from where it was, but coming back. There was a little bit of rise in hours of work, which maybe it will help, but I think there's going to be risks around the inventories and other factors. So it's not clear to me precisely what we're going to see, but I would expect to see everybody celebrating upside, 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 based on, you know, we've solved the recession and we're now in recovery. I just think we're in the foothills of recovery and we've got a long, long way to go. And my own view is that it could well take quite a lot longer. But we'll see. GDP comes out tomorrow. I'll probably do a show about that tomorrow evening. I've told you about the new postcode tool. I just want to mention again the Walk the World Fund and Walk the World Super. That's the tie-up with Nucleus Wealth. If you are interested in a market exposure, there's a few shows I've done about that. I'm not trying to push it hard, but I'm just trying to give people two things. Access to financial advice via Nucleus Wealth, because a lot of people need that and want it, and I'm not able to do it. And secondly, a financial solution that actually has performed quite well and has reasonably good fees and massively great transparency. So, and in fact, Damien Klassen will be on in a couple of weeks, so we can talk about the markets with him then. Now, just in terms of the DFA blog, there's more data. You can subscribe on the blog and get alerts every time we blog. Just to remind you about that. Also, there's our Patreon program. You can get my data. You can get the stress data each month for $50 US a month. Quite a few people have that. Those people will very soon have first access to the postcode tool that I showed you today. We'll be writing by email to those people, inviting them to participate if they're interested. And that's effectively bundled up as part of the Patreon program initially. We'll make it more widely available later. That's $50 US plus GST a month. And you get access for every postcode across the country, a bit like what we've been seeing today. Also, our one-to-one service. If you want to have an individual discussion with me about a postcode, I don't give financial advice, but I can give you postcode information. Drill into the data like I've done high level tonight in more detail. We can look at the home price trends and all that sort of stuff and look at my modeling. Takes about 40 minutes to an hour to have a conversation via Zoom or on the phone. And there's a charge for doing that. And booking about 3 or 5 weeks ahead because it's so popular. So very interesting way of having a one-on-one conversation with me about a particular postcode. If you want more information about that particular service, contact me via the blog. Also, if you want postcode information, just the high-level summary, the one page, and I haven't been able to give it to you on air tonight, send me an email via the DFA blog. And once again, I'm very happy to send it to you. It may take me a day or two to get to it because I get a lot of requests after these shows. Send me an email with the postcode and I will then send you back the one-page summary. I'll also be advertising once the tool is more widely available. We're still working on the sort of the finalization of it to make sure it's accurate and it does everything we want it to work. But it's looking pretty good now and it's certainly quite a powerful tool, I think. Just bear that in mind too. You can make a contribution via PayPal if you'd like to support our work. We do rely on support from those who follow us here, not making profit, just covering the costs, because there's a lot of costs involved in doing all the stuff we do. And the more support we get, the more research that we can do, the more interviews we can do, the more programs we can make. Or indeed buy Bitcoin. There's also some merch there. We've got this little logo. And you can see the merch on the channel. It's also via Teespring directly. That's the URL there. Next week, Tony LeCantre will be on for his year-end review. Tony is one of our most popular participants, always good value, always worth listening to. So he'll be on next week. Mark your diaries. And if you've got specific questions for him, you can ask them either live on the show or indeed beforehand via the DFA blog. And I think it'll be a very interesting. He's got some really interesting views about small caps, gold and bio and those sorts of things, but also a perspective more broadly about the overall economic situation that we're in. And I should also just say that in terms of future shows, the following week it'll be Damien Klassen from Nucleus Wealth, and we're going through the latest economics and macro view. And the week after that, we will have Edwin Almeida on for effectively a live review of the year just before Christmas. So he's coming on. Also, next Monday, it's not a live show, but Edwin and I will be talking to SQM Louis Christopher. And we'll be talking about his modelling and his thinking. And that show will be up next Monday. So that'll be an interesting one to keep an eye out for too. All right. I will therefore, I think come to the point now of saying, I think that's pretty much it. I'm just going to go down. Thanks to Jason. Thanks to Dean and Telia for the contributions. Manfly, Cookie Boy, help Core Logic Index get back up and running. Thanks, Cookie Boy. Good point. And Dennis as well, and G2. I think we've done everybody. If I've missed anybody who's made a contribution, I just want to say thank you very much. And I really appreciate all of those contributions. It is quite complex on the sorts of show he is to be able to cover all these things off. But I do really appreciate all your support. Please do share these posts as widely as you can. I've got another 2,000 subscribers I need to get to get the 50,000 by the end of the year. And if we could do that, that would be terrific. That would be an amazing, I mean, I wouldn't have thought that, if, you know, 6 months, a year ago, that we'd get anywhere close. But please do share. Also, I've had a number of people who've contacted me having been told about the show from somebody else who's been watching the show, and they've got huge value and huge benefit from both the current shows, but also the archive of shows as well. So again, if you think that it would be useful, please pass it on. And I have to say that that's pretty much it. Thank you very much for spending time with me tonight. Don't forget Tony next week. Keep watching the shows meantime, and I'll look forward to seeing you next week. This is Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, signing off.